Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Kevin, on Wednesday, we lost a member of the Top Chef community. Floyd Cardoz passed away after a battle with COVID-19. Cardoz, you might remember, was the winner of Top Chef Masters back in 2011, season 3. With a highly successful restaurant called Tabla, Cardoz was the first Indian-born and raised chef to lead an influential New York City kitchen, according to the New York Times. And in 1999, writing for the New York Times, Ruth Reichel wrote a glowing review of Tabla, Chef Cardoz's restaurant he opened up with Danny Meyer. She wrote, "Yes, I thought, this is what I've been waiting for. This is American food viewed through a kaleidoscope of Indian spices." So if the name Ruth Reichel is familiar, that is the guest judge from this week's episode of Top Chef. So on Wednesday, Padma on her Twitter account had this to say about Floyd. "Floyd Cardoz made us all so proud. Nobody who lived in New York in the early aughts could forget how delicious and packed Tabla always was. He had an impish smile, an innate need to make those around him happy, and a delicious touch. This is a huge loss, not only for the professional food world, but for Indians everywhere. My heart goes out to his wife, Barka, and their whole family. Rest in peace, Floyd." So Kevin, in honor of Cardoz's enduring smile, let's have some fun.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I am Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, this was sort of a love letter, a culinary love letter to Los Angeles, the city I've lived and eaten in for the last 23 years. I was very, very absorbed in this. And like all these places, some of which I go quite frequently. There's some really good food. I mean, that was sort of the thing. Jonathan Gold is a legend. His origin story is famous among Angelenos who love food and, frankly, people nationally. He was a guy who had a job working just, I think, at a legal journal or a legal newspaper, worked downtown and decided on a whim one day, you know what, I'm going to eat at every single restaurant on Pico Boulevard as long as it takes me. And just so people know, Pico Boulevard runs from downtown Los Angeles all the way to the beach. So you were talking about miles and miles of just commercial real estate. So we're talking, I can't even fathom the number of restaurants, but that was his thing. He was going to eat at like every taqueria, every kosher joint through Pico Robertson, every Japanese place, et cetera, et cetera. And that is what launched not only his career, Tom, but a new kind of food criticism. There was a time in this country, 30, 35, 40 years ago, where there were only certain kinds of restaurants with certain kinds of pedigrees that got reviews. The idea that you would review, like would employ real critique and real criticism on a pupusaria was just nothing anybody ever did.
A food truck.
Right. I mean, the idea that you would – that food criticism was reserved for this kind of food over here and this other kind of food over here. Hey, have fun. By all means, partake. But it wasn't really integrated into food criticism. And that's what Gold did. And I think when kind of people who may not be from Los Angeles or that matter not kind of know the criticism world, it's like, well, why is this episode obsessed with this guy? Isn't this just enough already? I just don't think you can overstate Gold's influence on the entire food world, and particularly here in Los Angeles. Counterintelligence, a compendium of many of his reviews that came out, I think, in like 99, 2000. That thing was like riding around in my car for 10 years. I mean, I literally like that was my, not my guidebook to LA food, my guidebook to Los Angeles altogether. So I love this episode. And that is more my sort of opening shot in honor of Gold.
Yeah, Anthony Bourdain once described Gold as the first guy to change the focus from white tablecloth restaurants to really cool little places in strip malls. And I don't know if Anthony Bourdain has the career he has on TV without Jonathan Gold. The idea that you could learn about culture and communities and traditions, ethnicities, just by going to eat at their restaurants, that's very much a Jonathan Gold spirit, right?
Yeah, and one of the things that I found really heartening, and I literally got a lump in my throat because I love Meals by Janae. I think I went on my like fourth date with Eric to Meals by Janae, and I love that place. And to watch, and I think it's Janae. I mean, I think I'm pronouncing that correct. Just kind of become overcome with emotion, just retelling sort of the moment at which Gold sort of recognized that as the leading Ethiopian place in town. In a really vibrant Ethiopian community next to Washington, D.C., I think Los Angeles has the second largest Ethiopian community. And that little stretch on Fairfax between Olympic and Pico is just a wonderful – it's where I go to buy Ethiopian groceries. And if you go to Meals by Janae, it's wonderful. But just kind of watching her overcome, watching the owner of Mayura talk about it. It's just like, you know, we live in this weird era where people criticize the Columbusing of food or somehow cultural appropriation or there's something cheapening about, you know, assembling a list of places that might not otherwise get recognized or might not otherwise even people like you or me be aware about that somehow that's cheapening or a certain brand of appropriation. I've always taken offense to that because like when you go to these places, these are working families that are running restaurants whose margins are impossible. I mean, to make it as a restaurateur, particularly one that serves that isn't getting $38 a plate, is just impossible. My family ran the Jewish deli in Atlanta, like the definitive Jewish deli for 60 years. And like, they were just always scrapping. So it was just really cool to have Gold celebrated. Forget the chefs. Like my favorite moments of the show were Gold being celebrated by the restaurateurs themselves. And just being just so moved by the recognition that Gold gave them.
And I think Los Angeles as a city needs someone like Gold because it's so hard to go to all the different parts of Los Angeles because it's such a sprawling city and there's so many different corners of the city in ways that New York City isn't. You know, like if you wanted to go eat in Koreatown or have a meal in different parts, you just hop in a subway and you're there, right? In Los Angeles, you have to put in work. You have to get in your car and drive and sit in traffic and find that strip mall. And so the idea of Gold giving you this little guidebook, this map, this little, a map of exploration for Los Angeles, it's not an easy thing to do. And so for him, I thought of you, Kevin, when watching this episode of the Ethiopian meal, because we have shared an Ethiopian meal over in Boston together, and that is a meal of love. Like, an Ethiopian traditional meal is not like your typical meals. You get dirty, no. You get into it, and that is very much the spirit of Jonathan Gold, is that it is love, it is communal, and it is an experience.
Right. I mean, and what I love about Gold is, first of all, yeah, Ethiopian is my favorite, as you know, because you know I have a long-standing opposition to utensils in general. So that there's that. But Gold kind of created a world where you're going to come home for dinner with some oil on your shirt, you know, with a little splat or with a stain. And you're absolutely right. There's so many of us who kind of learned the city through kind of Gold's roadmaps, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it is like I became familiar with, you know, having arrived in LA, I wasn't overly familiar with the San Gabriel Valley. I mean, I knew it on a map, but I wasn't familiar with the communities that were there. And it is a place because, as you say, Los Angeles is really tough to tackle. You know, you moved to New York, and I remember I did this when I was in college. Like, you can walk Broadway on a Sunday morning. Like, I would literally walk from campus on 116th Street down to the 31 Division Street dim sum house. So it would like take me an hour, 45 minutes, 2 hours, and I would do it. But Los Angeles, you got to kind of, you're not going to, as you say, you kind of need a little bit of a roadmap. These nooks and crannies exist in shopping malls, and they're at blush kind of indistinguishable from one another. And so in many ways, so many of us discovered the city itself through the culinary trail. It wasn't, oh, okay, let's go to this neighborhood and we'll find some place to eat. It's, hey, I don't know a hell of a lot about Alhambra. You know, why don't we go to this Whighorn restaurant on New Avenue? Or why don't we go, you know, I've heard a lot about Golden Deli, but I've never been. And then kind of use that as a perch from which to explore the city.
Did you, now that we can get into the actual episode here, did you think that there was going to be a Jonathan Gold episode? When you found out that this was going to be an LA-themed season, did that pop in your head of like, oh, are we going to get a Jonathan Gold episode, or were you like pleasantly surprised? Ooh, yes, we get a Gold tribute episode.
Like, actually, I think if you'd asked me, I would have said, oh yeah, that would have made sense, but it didn't even occur to me.
Yeah.
And then, and it's right off the bat. I mean, there's a reason, again, you do episode 2. This wasn't episode 7 or 8. Like, you can't even really do a competition show, a culinary competition show in Los Angeles without Gold, particularly since he's passed away. I mean, I think that's the other thing, is like, he died, I think it was 2017. So, you know, I think, It's different when there's a living soul, that's one thing, but he died suddenly and just left this huge gaping hole. Anyway, so that's it. And so there we go. We get to the episode. I think the chefs are as overcome as we are, and they split up into 4 groups, kind of going into 4 different directions around Los Angeles. I can't tell you, Tom, what a fun thing it was to watch, like, them show up at the Mariscos Jaliscos. I've got to take you for the deep fried shrimp taco at Mariscos Jalisco. That is one of my favorite bites.
Oh, can I
town.
Also get the pile of octopus too?
Yeah, you can. I mean, it is a wonderful place. And again, it's down there, like, I think it's you know, an East Olympic, essentially. They had gitlada, which they have one of my other favorite dishes in Los Angeles, the Morning Glory salad. The meals by Janae, the shiro there is wonderful. She does this lamb stew that I love. And then Eric and I, one of our favorite restaurants, kind of more upscale, is, like, we go to Republique and we get the Dover sole. Like, it is one of our favorite plates collectively in Los Angeles. So it was just so fun to see these places.
It must have been it must have been just so much fun for you to watch.
Yeah. By the way, I will say, I've had good, not great meals at Lhasa, which ended up being an inspiration, I think, for that entire group, the Filipino place. Mm-hmm. Though there's so much great Filipino food in town, and there were some great dishes. They do a beef tartare at Lhasa that I really, really love. But so you had a fourth of the group going to kind of the downtown corridor, which was, you know, sort of Chinatown, and then in Rust Blue downtown. You had the East LA, which was actually really the San Gabriel Valley plus Morisco, Jalisco. You had the West Side, and then you had the Hollywood group. And the West Side did Miura and a couple places over there. And then you had sort of the Republic was sort of the beachhead for the Hollywood gang, and along with Jitlada.
All right, so you're a chef. Okay, you're top chef competing right now, Kevin. They give you four groups here: East LA, West LA, Hollywood, and downtown. Power rank me those four for you.
Well, it's tough. I mean, East Side, I mean, San Gabriel Valley is a miracle. Like the San Gabriel, there's no place like the San Gabriel Valley. I mean, you're just talking about the cradle of Asian food in North America. You know, now people in Vancouver might have something to say about that, and possibly San Francisco, but it is just, I mean, you're talking about miles and miles. I mean, going down Valley Boulevard, going down Las Tunas, going just, you know, Atlantic into Maine along, going Garvey when you go south of the 10 in Monterey Park. Like there's no place like it. Now, my issue is, Tom, with each passing year, do you know about my spicy issue right now?
No.
All right. So I used to eat spicy food all the time with no consequence. I mean, moving to New York in 18, like we go to East 6th Street, we'd eat a lot of Indian food. I was like anybody else who loves world cuisine. I like a little heat. I like challenging myself. When I turned 30, it started to become an issue, where like my colon was set on fire after like going to my favorite Thai restaurant in Los Angeles, which is Yai. And then like, okay, I can deal with this a little bit. Then it was like, okay, I can only deal with this if I have 24 hours to recuperate. Like I'm not leaving the house the next day. And lately, the last 3 years, if I even have a hint of a Thai chili, it's not that my scalp gets a little sweaty. Like they have to bring out a towel from the kitchen. And this is now only the last 3 or 4 years. Like it's gone progressively bad, and I don't have an explanation. And if one of our listeners has an explanation, like a biochemical explanation, or if there's something I can take before going to Chengdu Taste, I would love to know it, because I love spicy food. It fucking hates me with like the heat of a thousand suns, quite literally. And it's really impeding my eating. Like I couldn't have gone to that with, I could not have gone with Melissa and that gang to those places. And even Morisco Jalisco's, like they have this great other tostada. What the hell is it called? The Dynamite, I think. And it's just too spicy for me. Like there's now food that is literally too spicy for me. And it's like worse than Albert Brooks in Broadcast News. It is. I'm not talking like a little couple beads of sweat on the scalp. I'm talking about like people are afraid I'm having a heart attack.
So, full disclosure, this is not a plug for ALS Piper Challenge for you to do it at home. But if you were to...
That's why I just sent you the money, dude. I just sent you the money.
If you were to do the ALS Piper Challenge, which I started a couple years ago in honor of my mom, who's battling ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, we learned some things about it. One, habaneros are really fucking hot. Okay, habaneros are like 100 times hotter than a jalapeno.
By the way, don't let me tell you about the time I accidentally rubbed my eyes after cooking with habaneros.
Got to be careful. Got to be careful with the habanero, especially. Man, that's like a jalapeno on steroids, on top of steroids. So one thing we learned, Kevin, is that people are being misled. There's myths about the antidote to spice. People think you have to drink milk. People think it's bread. But actually, scientifically, the thing that seems to biologically cap those receptors that create that the beads of sweat on your head, or at least the fire-breathing tongue of yours, the antidote to that is citrus. So if you take like a shot of – or a squeeze of lime or lemon
– Before or after?
After.
Okay.
It kind of mutes it a little bit. So people at home, if you're eating something super spicy, and maybe this is why there's a lot of citrus in Indian food or Mexican food or anything that has a lot of chilies in it, because it does – it's not going to completely numb it. This is like an icy hot on a sore calf, okay? It is going to be able to numb it somewhat, way more than milk. Actually, milk exacerbates the problem. So for those who are at home who are watching this episode or deciding, you know what, I'm going to go to that Thai restaurant tonight, or I'm going to go get that habanero salsa, make sure you have a lime on hand. Just in case you take a tequila shot and then you have something spicy, you can finish it with a nice wedge of wine, of lime. So, Kevin, back to this episode. So Nini's super adorable in the back with the car full of dads.
Well, we're going to get to Nini.
Yeah. And the four teams, I guess, there's Melissa, Lisa, Karen. The other team is Eric, Kevin, and
but they're not teams, right? They're pods.
Pods. Yes.
They're not in competition. They are merely, common fellow explorers.
Yes.
Fellow travelers.
Yes. Sailors going across the interstates. Yes. Eric, Kevin, Angelo, Gregory, Jen, Steph, Leanne, and then also finishing up Nini, Brian, and Jamie. So take us through.
Right. There's no quick fire because they want to give plenty of time on the hour to the culinary exploration of Los Angeles. I think a couple things happened here. I think there's such a thing as too much inspiration. I think the tour was so rich and so deep and covered so many different kind of culinary bases. You know, I mean, you had Filipino food on top of Italian food on top of that. I think a lot of these chefs, because I think A, the combination of pressure to pay homage to gold, I think B, 200 people, which it can be an issue as we've seen on the show time and time again. And C, I just think it was information overload. I think they thought too hard.
I love this.
And because
theory.
I think there were, yeah, I mean, I just think, by the way, there were clearly some great dishes, but there were a lot of issues. And I do, and this was Eric's theory, kind of watching it, that like there's such a thing as too much inspiration. Rather than just saying, you know what? Here's a protein, here's a flavor, here's sort of a theme that I grasp, I'm just going to do a thing. And I think some did. I mean, I think Brian Voltaggio got the challenge. I think Gregory, though it might not have been his best food, got the challenge. I think kind of Jen got the challenge. Those weren't necessarily the winners, but I think that there was just Lisa got the challenge. But I think there was sort of this, I got to do kind of street food, but I got to pay homage to this thing. And then I also did 200 people. And I think some of the chefs really struggled for that reason. And so you want to go through it?
On that note, I think this was surprising to me that I just want to talk about Brian Voltaggio for a second here.
Yeah.
The idea of having all of these different culinary influences after a day of eating at all these amazing restaurants. And by the way, Kevin, how many do you think of these chefs know the chefs at these behind these restaurants? So you're almost feeling like you have to pay homage to those chefs behind the scenes because, hey, that's my buddy. Like,
I don't know. I mean, because the one thing about – I would say this. There's sort of a conventional culinary community, the kind of the James Beard people and frankly, like chefs, sort of that. I mean, what I think makes these places so special, like I remember going in, I remember going to Philadelphia and going to that place that had gotten the Hardina. So I was just going there. There's an Indonesian family run restaurant that is like the size of a postage stamp in Philadelphia. And they got like I forget what the award is that Beard dispenses, but it's sort of it's not these technical chefs who've come through the system. It's for a family kind of heritage place. And I was in there a few months after they got the award. And then the young woman in the family who kind of works the front of, not even the front of the house, works the cashier because you order at the register. Yeah. I said, congratulations. And she's like, thank you. She's like, you know, it's funny. We didn't know what that was. Right. I think with a lot of the chefs, I mean, these are family run places and it's not like these are folks who came up through the culinary farm system, as to use a parallel from sports. So I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, obviously Russ Blue, there were a few, I think the Lhasa guys kind of have some relationship. But I think many of the places, like it's possible, I don't know, maybe they know the Shangdu place. I suspect Melissa might. I mean, she grew up in that neighborhood, I think. But
there might be a little bit of that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe the Miura couple – is part of the culinary community in Los Angeles, probably me now, but I don't know that they sort of came up through the sort of young 20-something, my class of chefs around the country who, essentially are aspiring to similar goals.
So Brian Voltaggio, he goes with the Filipino dish that he kind of doesn't know what he's doing. Like he's eaten at Filipino restaurants before, but this brings us back to one of the age old questions in Top Chef competition, right? We talked about it a bunch on the show. Do you go and cook your food that you know, a dish that you know? Because in this episode, since you're pulling from so many different strings, the idea could be, the strategy might be, hey, I'm going to take a protein from this meal that I had and I'm going to do a dish. Like you said, a dish that I know I can nail versus, man, that Filipino restaurant was amazing. I don't really cook much Filipino food, but I'm going to go for it on this dish. And I thought that was a risk by Brian Voltaggio and it paid off big time. What do you think?
I mean, so I have a lot to say about Voltaggio in this episode. I mean, I know he didn't win, but in some ways he was as impressive, and for this reason. One is, I think he found the sweet spot in the dialectic you're talking about, right? Like, Voltaggio knows great technical cooking. He knows how to put components on a dish, and there's a certain, as I think Gail said, a refinement to his work. But he also wants to pay homage, right? You don't have to go full, you don't have to do pan-seit if you're doing Filipino food. You know, take a protein that you know how to cook with, a short rib. And then just, I think in terms of flavor profile, you know, Filipino has a lot of kind of tangy sourness in a way, you know, a lot of black pepper. I mean, like I think he did that. And then, okay, now I know also, I don't care what you're cooking. Every dish in every culture needs balance. So, okay, there's a certain richness to this. I'm doing charred eggplant puree. How about some fermented radish? You're still kind of keeping in the Asian arena, but you're providing sort of the hit you need against the richness, yet still kind of conforming to the overall thing of the show. I thought he was good. The other thing I really liked about him was there were a lot of snacks, but there weren't a lot of plates.
Yep. Yep.
He made a dish. There was a lot of street. And again, I love street food as much as anybody, but there were a lot of snacks.
A lot of bites.
A lot of, oh, my play on nachos or my. He did a plate. He assembled essentially an entree. Like, you could go into a restaurant, get short ribs with charred eggplant puree, fermented radish, and butternut squash vinaigrette.
That is a meal.
That is a plate you would expect on the main entree list at a place you love. And I thought that was, you know, I won't say it was bold. I mean, I'm surprised more chefs didn't kind of try playing it that way. Play homage, but still kind of come up with something fully formed rather than a bite or a snack, which is great, but it's not going to win you.
Where do we want to go here? Do we want to go plate by plate, dish by dish? How do we want to do this? Because, man, there's lot of good food here.
All right. So there were some interesting things I think we saw, even starting at the Whole Foods. Like we had there was a sense of foreboding with Eric, right? He wants to do his duck. They don't have duck, or Lisa gets the last duck. Jamie had some duck too, but I think he needed a full duck. Lisa got it first. He recovers, goes with scallop, and he's going to do, he's going to kind of do East African profiles. He's going to do a braised cabbage and scallop.
Eric needs to get some more speed. This is the second episode, 2 for 2, where he gets boxed out on one of his ingredients. Come on, Eric.
I didn't think about that. You're right. The second week in a row where he didn't really procure what he wanted to from the cupboard / deli counter or whatever, that butcher counter or whatever. So I think there were some other interesting things like, Brian and Melissa both doing beef tartare, which I think is actually a smart way to go for a 200 person thing. And also, you know, the nice thing about beef tartare is it's almost like a pair of khakis. You want a little Szechuan spice, you do it with Szechuan spice. You want it to be the kimchi vinaigrette, you can go that way. You like your fermented egg yolk from the Filipino place, you can throw that in there, right? Because what's better in a beef tartare than an egg yolk, right? You saw Angelo be over-inspired. He just gets in his head. Yep. It's all turmeric all the time. He's going to do that coconut broth. Stephanie, and it's so funny because I actually said it in the thing. I'm like, oh, you never cook Indian food for Padma. And she knew it the minute she realized it. But like,
two whammies. It's like flatbread and then cooking Indian food for Padma.
Right. And by the way, like, and you know, I'm very bullish on Stephanie, though this week definitely gave me a pass. But like, flat, non, really, really, you're going to make like, don't be a bread maker. Has anyone ever won a challenge? Because Tom and Padma said,
wow, this gyro is just delicious. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it just stay away. Like, it's not going to win you anything. It's especially for 200 people. It's only going to either be overly soggy or overly dry or not really do anything for the dish. And I just like it's just again, there are some times where you see the error surface before it even implodes. And that was another one of those things.
Kevin, on this, I had to ask you, okay, what is the thing that Padma or Tom, a question they give you that sends the most shivers down your spine? So when Tom asks Steph, do you cook a lot of Indian at home? That question, whether you do or not, that question is the kiss of death. So I feel like if I got that question, I don't know how I would answer it. You would be like, if you did cook a lot of Indian at home, you might look like an idiot because he is asking that question for a reason. He's asking it because usually 9 times out of 10, you are not doing that authentically. You're not doing that very well. And the other question that Tom gave was, you think you actually did that? I forget what it was, but there was a moment where he asked, a chef was like, oh, I prepared it this way.
Who wasn't?
And he goes, do you think you actually did that? That's another just a horrifying question from Tom. So up there with, did you taste this
up
food?
There with, was there a pastry chef in the back?
There's so many, like, man, there's so many lines.
Oh, we'll get to Ruth Reichel. Oh, man. We'll get to Ruth Reichel.
But Tom, particularly in this one, there were so many throwback lines from past chef seasons where you just wanted to curl up in the fetal position and just disappear. Because do you cook a lot of Indian food at home? I bet Steph, when she was asked that, just wanted to vanish.
I will say that the other one, I mean, Tom is actually a master of the loaded question. Like, you just know, as you said, Tom, he's going to come into a kitchen, look over your shoulder and say, oh, do you always not seed the squash before you prepare it? Like it's just, you're going to, it is a almost 94% guarantee that the loaded question is going to prove fatal in some form or fashion.
Have you used chicken stock before with this dish?
Yes. Do you always scratch your ass before putting it back, your hand back in the, you know, in the bowl? So there were some interesting things. So there were a couple of things that I am shocked that Leanne, let's go one by one. Like, yeah. So I was shocked Leanne didn't up on the bottom. Like, to me, the only time fish and cheese ever works is like a really good tuna melt. I mean, obviously salmon and cream cheese is a famous combo. So maybe I shouldn't say that, but like, I was just sure that the Hayashi,
And, it was all over the place. I don't know. Leanne's, I felt like she was in your preface here on this particular challenge where you have to draw from so many different inspirations. I feel like that might have been information overload.
By the way, Shunji is my favorite sushi place in Los Angeles. What's great about Shunji is it's like there's not even a sign. It just says Japanese food. it's a little place, and I've been there with many of our ESPN colleagues back in the day. By the way, so if there are Japanese specialists in our audience, I was a little confused with Leanne because Hayashi I thought was like a Japanese beef fried rice, and I didn't see that in the bowl. I was just curious that maybe I don't know what Hayashi is, and it's very possible. But
with mozzarella,
yeah, I was shocked. With mozzarella, I was shocked she didn't up at the bottom. I was like, crab and cheese and plums. No, this is not going to work. Do you know who got the least kind of attention? And actually, your boy Jamie. Like, they spent the least amount of time with him than any of the other 13 chefs. He does a classic Los Angeles staple, which is the elevated street taco.
Yep.
I think there are probably cynics in Los Angeles now who are, God, if I have one more duck mole taco with the crema. I love this genre of food. Gorilla Tacos does it well. Guisado's is one of my favorite places in town. There are so many of them now that I think there is a law of diminishing returns, and people roll their eyes at, oh, great, another place that's serving elevated street tacos. But I just always have loved it.
This was a middle dish. It was a safe dish. So
did any of the critics or judges even say one nice or bad? No. I mean, I don't remember his even getting a hearing.
No, I don't think he even – I think it was – I think he just talked about his duck mole taco, and then that was it. There was no review. So it was a safe dish, and it was perfectly in the middle. So hats off to you, Jamie.
I want to say talk about Lisa for a second, because as you know, we did her the dishonor of picking her. Neither of us picking her. She is the free agent to be after next week's show. For the second straight week, Tom, she cooked a really good smart dish. She did a spicy caramel duck, that wonderful kind of almost Vietnamese, I think like cane, palm sugar plus fish sauce. I'm assuming that's what the caramel duck was. And then with this pickled chili salad. She, again, like Baltazar, she made a real plate. And I got to tell you, she's looking pretty strong. I think you and I might have, she might become the Pat Beverly of our, not even Pat Beverly. Like, you know, the best undrafted would be.
Udonis Haslam?
Yeah, he's going to be the Udonis Haslam of this competition. Because I got to tell you, she's cooking well. Likewise, who did a good dish? Interesting to see not on the top, because Gregory, I just felt like juggernaut, clearly did well. And his halibut and turmeric and tomato broth. This is a man, Tom. It's like whenever I get stuck in the kitchen, I just need to summon my inner Gregory, because
this dish was perfect.
But it's even more like he makes achieving balance so effortlessly. Like when you see the description of his dish, when it flashes on the screen, you're always like, yeah, of course, yeah. Right? Like chilies, lime, and pineapple, sweet, sour, spicy, sweet, sour, spicy. And you're looking at it and you're like, of course. Yeah. Like all the guy does is fucking crush his protein, put three wonderfully mingling tastes, kind of flavor bits, combines them with absolute cohesion, and voila. And like, this is why the man is never on the bottom. This is why in his completely unheralded, I'm not even going to be on the top three, he still cooks what appeared to be what Ruth Reichel called a perfect dish. So I just hats off to Gregory for being awesome, even when he's not recognized.
I know. I had a lot of questions about the top three, bottom three, and elimination in this episode. So let's keep plowing through it.
Let's work on the middles. Like, let's just go down the middles. Yeah. All right. So Brian Malarkey.
Holy shit.
By the way, like clearly the heel of the competition this year. I mean, I think it's fair to say a fried rice beef tartare with kimchi vinaigrette and fermented yolk egg actually sounds reasonably tasty, but the presentation was just looked like a slasher film. And Ruth Reichel, which I actually thought was her most cutting insult of the day. We'll get to hers of Angelo, but like said, this is a dish that people who hate restaurants hate about this.
It was so good. It was so good. And that's exactly what I thought. It was overly tweezery, right? And the way he presented it was another element that just made you roll your eyes, where he kept telling Padma and the rest of them who would walk away from this, like, you prepared to be blown away, ladies, or like, this is gonna be the best dish you taste all night. It screamed insecurity. No, like, this is.
And you know what it looked like, Tom? It looked like the surviving calf of the cow that was killed threw up all over the plate.
It was, and maybe he knew that. Maybe he had to add some gusto, some expository to get past what it looked like. It was just, I felt I was cringing because I thought we were being prepared for him getting kicked off the show this week, because it just seemed like over the top, like every 3 seconds, it was another malarkey over the top description of his food. And I just thought, man, he is going to get kicked to the curb on this one, but he wasn't. So he, despite his commentary, he was not in the bottom or the top.
You know who looked to have a reasonably successful dish, just there probably wasn't bold enough? Jen Carroll's cooking well, and she did a chickpea and navy bean soup with hominy, this lovely-looking herb yogurt. And it seemed to achieve a texture balance, a flavor balance, sort of cool, hot combo. And, I mean, she wasn't on the top, maybe because it just wasn't bold enough. I mean, she's cooking kind of essentially without a protein. It's still a hearty dish, but you know, it, but she, got praise from the chefs, and, you know, it's cooking well, Tom. You got Jen Carroll.
Yeah, I was a fan of this. And also I'm a fan of the whole like sour cream dollop in your chili or a yogurt in your soup. So I was a big fan of this one. I just think when you're doing a vegetable dish, it's hard to win in Top Chef. Just because without the protein, I feel like in this episode, it was hard to get into that top three. Obviously, when there's 14 contestants, it's hard to get in the top three anyway. But this was especially, it seemed pretty hard for her to crack into the top three without a protein, but a well-executed dish.
You know, it's funny you say the herb yogurt. I've been cooking a lot with that in the last few years. What I've realized is on a night where I just want to roast beets or roast carrots, like when you roast kind of a rooty vegetable, and you just like blend up some yogurt with your favorite herbs, anything but cilantro, basically, maybe a little mint,
yep,
tarragon, whatever. And you just kind of, it elevates your lazy ass roast carrots, honey roasted carrots that I just throw on the, I roast in the oven. And then you kind of put that on, like, you know, kind of pile that on. All of a sudden you look like Mr. Chefy. Mm. And yet it's actually the easiest thing in the world. If you have a Vitamix, you just throw in like good Greek yogurt, full fat place. And a bunch of herbs you like, and you're there. And it also has that kind of green, little blast of color. So I am a big fan of the herb yogurt. It has made my very pedestrian food look more sophisticated than it actually is. And then our final middler was my girl Karen, who I thought that was one where I was like, oh, shit. You know, that was an oh, shit.
The ominous, I got to do 200 dumplings.
I'm going to do 200. That was and bless Sasto's heart. It was a move out of his book. Like I'm going to stretch myself to the mere, to the ultimate depths of human capacity to make this dish. She does a pan fried cumin lime dumpling, which looked fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Really tough assignment, but she nailed it. And like degree of difficulty might've had one of the biggest successes of the day, though didn't have one of the three best bites of the day. Do we want to go top or bottom?
Well, let's hit on Melissa real quick. The Szechuan.
Oh, that's right. That's my last. I forgot about.
What did you think about that? So I was kind of nervous for her because I think you can do a really good dish, but if Tom gets the chili pepper and just throws it off for her, that might be. You know, that might be it for her. And I was nervous because I was like, man, what if you nail the dish, but someone just got too much spice in there. Someone had a Kevin Arnovitz over the top, could not handle the spice there. And that might have sent her home. And I was nervous about it. But man, it looked like a great dish. And compared to Brian Malarkey, I feel like she had the superior tartare.
I think it's hard to place with 14 players with a beef tartare. Like, I think it's something you can place with once you get down to six or seven.
Yeah.
But, and by the way, can you name the five spices in Chinese five spice?
No.
I was able to name three of them. I knew it was anise, cinnamon, and I thought it was like red peppercorns at Sichuan pepper. So I'll take credit for that one. I did not know that the other two were fennel seeds and cloves.
Mm.
Now I think you can mix and match. Like I think people would tell you, no, five spice can, there are other theories and schools on this, but I think that's the traditional five spice. And she did that five spice potato chips. I love that five spice combo. I sometimes do lazy chicken thighs, that's my rub.
Mm.
But I think it's hard to place with beef tartare with 14. There's always going to be three things more impressive. It's just let's face it, it's degree of difficulty. The chili pepper question is a good one, Tom. I kind of got the sense that there's a little more patience. It's understanding that when you – you know, the shishito, every seventh pepper, there is a certain inherent risk when cooking with that kind of stuff. And I think there's a certain patience that you're not going to get booted unless it was just off the charts. Plus, Padma is a notorious spice lover.
Yep.
So
I was happy with Melissa's dish. I feel like I would have expected, without Tom's response to it, I kind of felt like she was going to be in the top three. But the top three was super strong in this episode. And we already talked about Brian's dish. Let's talk about Nini's.
I am just going to crow about Tom Haberstroh.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Is there a week in the seven that she has been an active chef in this show where she has not cooked one of the two or three best dishes? Not including, let's say, the quickfires, I believe she won. Did she win quickfires? Am I correct?
Yeah, sure. Sure. I'd have to look at it. But Kevin, you're absolutely right. Another amazing dish from her. And I think when you look at Nini as a chef, she is five tool. She's got it. She, on this particular dish, it felt like she was pulling in different flavors from different backgrounds.
So remind us what she cooked.
The masa ball soup with the coconut milk. It was one of those things where when she said it, you're like, really? Just like Lisa at the Whole Foods, when she describes what she's going to make, Lisa just goes with a very condescending, really? That's what you're going to make? But man, Kevin, this seemed like something you would just spoon up into your mouth.
I think she might have, and we need Top Chef stats to kind of get us this. Our buddy over there, she should tell us. Does she have the highest average finish of any chef? I mean, I'm saying like what is her average finish?
All right, so she was middle round by round last season. She was middle, win out.
All right, but I want to stipulate something. Those two wins came when there were what, 15 people?
There should be a curve. Won. There should be
right.
There should be so, extra in other words, points. Yes.
So this is what it should be. It should be what percentile? What is her average percentile? Like if you finish third out of 15, that's you're in the 20th percentile. Frankly, that's like finishing second out of. That's better to me than finishing second out of 8.
Yeah, that's a great right? point.
Right. So I can't imagine there is a chef in 17 seasons who has a higher percentile per week finish than Nini Nguyen. I am feeling competent. This is a woman who literally has not laid one egg in 7 weeks of competition. She has great instincts. She honored what a masa ball soup. In fact, to me, she's the one person who really kind of, hey, if we're kind of fusing together Los Angeles, kind of, you know, Jewish Mexican cooking. This was a, you know, who this is a call out to?
Katsuji?
Yeah, that's kind of a very Katsuji kind of dish, except the difference is she doesn't futz it up with all these crazy shit. Like, yeah. I'm going to do a masa ball soup. It's going to sing on its own, and it's going to be in a coconut ginger broth. It's going to be clean, but it's going to be rich. It's going to be wonderful. I am feeling great about Nini. We've talked about Voltaggio, Tom. You've got to be feeling good.
Yeah, Voltaggio, just another strong performance from him. And, you know, he comes in with a really sparkling resume. Someone, like I said, feels like he's above this show. He's already competed on Top Chef Masters, but he comes in and just cooks his ass off. And again, in my opinion, I thought it was a risky move by him to do a dish, a Filipino dish that he admitted that he wasn't experienced in, but he did it anyway. And so I felt like, ooh, this is a bad move by Brian. You got to do a dish that you know, but he did the components well. He was in the top three. I was surprised he was in the top three given the remarks about the other chefs and the other dishes, but he's in the top three along with Nini. And oh man, Kevin, we are doing a great job drafting because my number one overall pick won last week's, and your number one overall pick won this week.
Yeah, and we'll, Kevin won the episode. Kevin Gillespie, I thought, took an enormous risk. I was the 25, 30 minutes in, Tom. I am like, what is he doing? He is going to make a fried terrine ball.
This is one of like, Kevin Arnovitz's cardinal sins.
What, terrine and
yeah, just doing a terrine.
Torshan?
Yeah.
Torshan and terrine? Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I'm just thinking, okay, there are 200 people here. You're going to deep fry. It's just like it's a hard quality control dish. Mm. Like you're going to deep fry 200 pork mushroom blackcurrant terrine balls. I'm thinking he should have his head examined. How do you pull this off? And, you know, I think Ruth Reichel, bless her heart. By the way, Ruth Reichel, veteran of L.A. Times, New York Times, and I think was the last ever editor at Gourmet. And just hilarious. Wonder. I mean, I just love the way she characterizes food. You know, she somehow anthropomorphizes other. These dishes don't talk to each other.
Yes.
Or it's just she's so brilliant at this. And as she said, I have the same impression. She's like, this is going to be a clunker, or this is going to be a disaster. He does this fried terrine ball, lovely little gem of a thing, and he puts it on the plate, even though it's brown. It somehow kind of shines, and then there's there's granny's apple butter, which Ruth Reichel says that he should get bottled. which clearly warmed his heart because, you know, grandmother's recipe, you got to love that. And he just nails it. Roast pork, mushroom, and black currants. It is apparently the bite of the night. It outdoes the truly formed kind of Gregory Voltaggio, Lisa kind of fully formed dishes. It just beats everything. And he's overcome. This is a man who's been fighting cancer for the better part of 2 years. And it's wonderful. I'm still a softie, Tom. Mm. I'm still a softie. I love that reaction.
The main reason I want to win is to prove I'm not dying. What a line from Kevin Gillespie, and what a performance in this episode. It was a risky dish to do live for 200 people, because I'd imagine some of those bites, it might be searing hot inside, right? From the deep fryer. I was just nervous for him, but he comes out on top.
You know, it's not something you want. It's not something you want room temperature either.
No. So the margin of error on this, it's just so razor thin that he was working with here, and he came out on top. So Kevin, congratulations on this win. It is, like you said, winning a competition this early in the competition, an elimination challenge, is really hard to do, especially in Top Chef All-Stars. So congratulations to Kevin.
So the bottom, we had Eric, who I think it's understood was kind of safe. I mean, he ranked 13th, but a bit of distance a bit ahead of 14th and 15th. 12th, but a bit of distance between 13, him and 13.
Yeah, he was in the bottom three, but it really felt like this was a bottom two.
You know, and I also wonder, I don't even know if he's there, given Malarkey and some of the others, if it sounds like this, the braised cabbage, which is one of those things that almost has to be perfectly mushy. And I mean, we all love, like, there's a miso braised cabbage that the folks at Vernick do in Philadelphia that I love. And braised cabbage is one of those things. I think Ruth Reichel said it, that just, or I think Tom maybe said, you can't have any crunch left. I just wonder if the braised cabbage is cooked a little longer, he's probably not even down there.
Yeah.
It looked like his scallop was perfectly cooked. Like, it was just one of those things where there was a technical error, cabbage that wasn't fully braised to the satisfaction of the judges. It's hard to know if you're not tasting it, but the judges seem to suggest there wasn't enough kind of connective tissue with the dish.
Yep. Was that the dish that inspired the line from Ruth that they're not talking to each other, the ingredients are not talking to each other? Might have been.
Yeah, I think that might have been it. It might have been the nachos. It might have been that. Yeah. Or they didn't say hello. Some part of a food is not, you know, fully anthropomorphized with it in talking or screwing or whatever it is, the other thing.
I thought Brian Malarkey was for sure going to take his place in the bottom three. What a surprise there. Kevin, holy, this bottom two, the lines from the judges, it felt like both of them might be going home.
Yeah. I mean, Stephanie, I was very disappointed in, because I feel like she's had a nice run. I think, you know, my book on her was she kind of got ejected unfairly from the last competition. So, you know, this is a chef that hasn't cooked poorly really ever in the history of the show. It was a terrible decision. Indian nachos, again, it's just so pedestrian. Like, it's like Mad Libs. Nachos of some other.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
unless it's a nachos challenge, right?
Like, hi, we're at Rupp Arena, cook stadium food for stadium people, or hey, it's the Super Bowl party, Top Chef edition, create a snack that, you know, a bunch of like frat boys want to eat, you know, like there's times and places for, you know, essentially, you know, for that kind of food. And look, I'm not saying there's nothing better than good nachos. I agree. Like, but it's just such a weird choice, especially when you're kind of doing, again, now you're putting yourself in a position where you have to be a baker. You got to be like a bread guy or a bread gal. And it's just like, come on. I mean,
and she owned it. She said two words. I don't even know if they're two words, but she said wicked oops, which I just burst out laughing, because that is probably the most Bostonian masshole thing to say, is wicked oops. It was great. Steph owned it. She said, I screwed up. I'm sorry. She figured it out mid meal, which she was like, oh no, I'm preparing Indian food for Padma. Wait.
Can I just say, bad decision? That wasn't the issue, right? Like Ruth said it herself. It was a dry, Tom does not like things that eat dry. And look, if you're going to, I mean, that was sort of the weird thing. If you told me, okay, the assignment is Indian nachos, my first reaction is, what? But if like I got to do it, I mean, chutney. That's what chutney's for. Yeah. I mean, chutney is the moist little just kind of acidic moist burst in an otherwise dry dish. Like I'm shocked there wasn't a chutney. It wasn't just like this idea that Ruth, it's like you got to have something. Or you know what you do? You do hello herbed yogurt. You're doing Indian. Yeah. Fine. Yeah. You know, do a, and as much as I hate to say it, like a cilantro yogurt, it's not my thing, but do an herbed yogurt. Like do something, as you know, Padma said, it just needs something, anything. But that was the thing. I mean, to me, yeah, cooking Indian for Padma, conceptual error. But tactical error is not giving the thing.
They described it as it didn't taste of anything.
Of anything. And
what?
Now, I'm still maybe this is a mulligan. I still think Stephanie's got pretty good instincts. Oh, man. But we finally get to our last chef, the chef that was eliminated. Chef, I think if I can take a little – I told you so. Like a chef, yeah. I think last week I said was not long for this competition.
You're right.
Seems like a prince of a guy, by the way. Just chill in the kitchen. Everyone likes him. Yep. Angela seems like just a swell dude. But my favorite line – not just like my favorite line in this episode, my favorite line, I think, in any since Bourdain, may he rest in peace, has been on the show and on the judges' table. That tuna died in vain.
I'm so glad you.
I think our title of this episode, Jade, the tuna that died in vain is the title of this episode.
This tuna died in vain. I have it circled and underlined.
Or is that a spoiler?
It might be. Maybe we can put it as wicked oops in the yeah. headline. But this tuna died in vain, Ruth. Like, bravo. Like straight up, that was an incredible line.
I'm sorry, but this tuna died in vain. I just love – you know what I love? Old Jewish women who grew up in Greenwich Village. Like – bless her heart. I mean, she's always been, you know, we talked about Silverton and gold. I mean, what I love about this season, Tom, is just all the true, like, human institutions of culinary America. Like, gold, Silverton, Reichel, they're all on their game. I mean, it's just, it's fantastic. So Angelo does this turmeric coconut broth that apparently is so sickly sweet that Tom Colicchio asked him if, when he was at Jitlada being inspired, whether there was a pastry chef there.
Yeah.
By the way, there is no pastry chef to my knowledge at Jitlada. Yeah.
And I think he knows that too.
So, and then he put a piece of kind of raw tuna, maguro, that Padma apparently liked. In fact, I got to tell you, Tom, as they were going to the suspense, I'm like, you know what? Padma liked his tuna just enough to save him. Stephanie's going home.
I could not agree more. I had in my notes, Angelo gone. Bye. Wow. I thought Steph for sure was getting sent home because in this dish, like you said, Padma actually spoke glowingly about a component in his dish, right? I don't think there was one even lukewarm positive remark about Stephanie's dish. There was nothing in this episode that made me believe that anyone other than Stephanie was going home. And yet Angelo goes home. And it seemed, you know, when Ruth says this tuna died in vain, like, man, that is such a haymaker of a comment. But still, I'm trying to think of anything in that episode that would lead you to believe that Stephanie's dish had something worth eating in there.
Also, this is a theory I have, and tell me to what extent you think it might be true. I have a theory that until we get to like, truly like a vote from the judges, that if Padma kind of likes it, that it like more so than Tom or any of the other judges, that like if Padma wants to pass it ahead, that it gets passed ahead. Like that, in other words,
no, but that doesn't make sense.
Tom's objections
on this one,
can
though.
Be overruled, but Padma, right, and this defies.
Yes.
That. So that was another, my point is,
yes.
That was another
you.
Reason I thought, yeah, I'm not articulating this well. I've always been under the assumption that if Padma's okay with it, it ain't going home. Mm. Now, if Tom's not okay with it, it might go home. If any of the other guest judges are okay with it, it might, you know, it might not go home. But when Padma kind of gives a dish a pass, that it
she's
gets
got
a pass.
The gavel.
That was
she,
the other thing.
She's the
right.
One.
Like she ultimately, you don't cross her. Like she will be the judge, jury, and executioner at the end. Maybe that's not true.
I was stunned about this, and Stephanie survives. Angelo, despite a solidly seasoned raw tuna, He gets sent home for an overly sweet dish. And it's very rare that you get an entree that is overly sweet. So sweet that, in fact, in the Last Chance Kitchen episode, Chef Mike just described it was like, that would have been too sweet for a dessert. That's how sweet it was. So Angelo, he gets a minus five for this episode to round out the scoring, Kevin, real quick. You picked up some ground. You picked up some ground. Yeah. You had, of course, the winning chef, Kevin Gillespie, Nini also in the top three. Stephanie, of course, didn't get you any numbers there with a zero. Brian Malarkey in the middle. For me, I just got a lot of solid innings. I had some inning eaters in this one. I had Gregory Gaudet with 2 points, Eric in the bottom three, 0 points, Brian Voltaggio in the top three, and then Melissa, Jen, Leanne, Jamie in the middle. So I just kind of accumulated a bunch of points for being in the middle. So I had 15 points in this episode. You had 14 points. It wasn't essentially a route like the first round. So right now the scoring is 41 for Team Tom, 24 for Team Kevin. So I guess you didn't close the gap. You actually didn't close the gap, but if this round two was much closer than round one. So far out to a commanding lead.
So interesting enough, the top four contestants are in order: Kevin, Gregory, Voltaggio, Nini. So
yeah,
basically draft picks 1, 2, 3, and 5 are in the top four. And I think for the first time in a while, and I think it has a lot to do, Tom, with the fact that we've seen these competitors before. I mean, I think it's a much easier season to handicap from the outset just because we know who these people are. But there is a certain... there's a certain symmetry to the draft order and, you know, what's going on in the scorecard.
Yeah. And Angelo gets sent home, and he was one of our last picks. And Lisa hasn't been blowing the doors off of people. She hasn't been bad either, but so far definitely more correlated than we have in the past, where like Tyler Anderson, my number one pick, wins the first.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot Jamie Lynch. I'm sorry. Let me correct myself.
Yeah. He's in there too, but you know what? Yeah. Like I'm with you. I think our drafting so far has been pretty top notch. I'm proud of our efforts so far. And watch, next week, Gregory, Brian, and Kevin will be in the bottom, right?
Real quick, Last Chance Kitchen.
Yes, you watched it.
Love Providence. Love that place. As a wedding gift, my friend John So, well, you may or may not have met, we took a couple that we're tight with. As a wedding gift, we were just like, I mean, I could send us another chef's knife or some freaking thing off the register. And we were just like, why don't we take, because we didn't go to the wedding. It was like 10 people in the Sea Islands of Georgia. Like no one went. And we just took them. We called ahead. They gave us a chef's table for four. I brought 2 bottles of wine, one red and white that I just absolutely love. I told them in advance. We got just, they did it up for us. It was just fun. And also there's a couple that we just adore. We just had the best 3.5 hours of dining. Among the best 3.5 hour meals of my life has been at Providence for that. And it was just, and it was one of those things where you're spending a ton of money, but it was like, hey, a round trip ticket to Savannah, you know, 3 nights at an expensive place in the Sea Islands, a rental car, everything else. It was like, oh, this is much better. I mean, it's 3.5 hours, and B, as a gift plus all those other things, I'm coming out ahead. And unlike most weddings, I actually get to enjoy the gift itself. So,
but you had a good time at my wedding. Favorite places. You had a good time.
Well, no. Yeah, absolutely. What I'm saying is like, but my gift to you, which I think was probably a chef's knife, this is what I get everybody, is a Japanese chef's knife. Like, in other words, I don't get use out of it. Whereas a dinner, it's like, hey, yeah. I'm there. I'm enjoying it with them. So, of course, I had a good time at your wedding. But anyway, so Providence is just for folks who know. It's just, I mean, he's just, talk about technical, brilliant cooking. I think he was the number one restaurant on Jonathan Gold's list, I think like 3 years
wow.
in a row. In a city that's got a lot of good restaurants. So Joe Sasto, giant clam, also known as geoduck, which I did not know. I've seen that word and I've seen giant clam. I did not know that. I think they're the same thing.
Yeah, the gooey duck is not a pretty looking thing. It is.
Yeah,
it is.
I said the geoduck. Yeah, gooey duck is a big schlong of a piece of seafood. Yeah. Who knows? I mean, it is just weird looking. Angelo makes the cardinal error right from the beginning, Tom. Right from the beginning. This is a man who doesn't understand the challenge. Like, they're bringing you to the best seafood restaurant in America, arguably, and you're showcasing eggs, of course.
Scrambled egg. I called it. Come on, man. Like, I know you're trying to do something just a little bit more refined, just something a little bit more focused, but come on, the scrambled eggs?
I'm sure it was actually, by the way, I mean, I did it say it as really I was good. Watching.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet that was a delicious bite, but that's not the challenge. That's not the challenge. The challenge is highlight a piece of seafood. You're going up against a guy who gets who chooses the highest degree of difficulty. You're going to lose. If he basically, I said it kind of watching. I was like, if Joe does anything above a BB+, there's nothing Angelo can do to eggs, cream, and caviar that's going to win him a challenge at Providence. It's just you don't like, you know, what's the Levitard thing? You don't understand the show?
Yeah.
You don't understand you don't get the show. You don't get the show. You don't get the show.
From a veteran.
The show is.
Angelo's a veteran on Top Chef. So it feels like in this Last Chance Kitchen, he should know, hey, think about the challenge and execute the dish that the challenge is presented. So I'm with you. And the other thing about caviar is there's no preparation of the caviar. It's you take a dollop out of the caviar and then you put it on your plate. So there's not even any technicality, I don't think, in that. So I was puzzled by the dish. And like they said, it was really delicious. The presentation looked very nice. It seemed like it was an elevated scrambled egg, which – you know, it sounds delicious, right?
But I'm sure it was delicious. And if the challenge is make breakfast,
yep.
do an elevated breakfast dish or a
surprise. Might be in the top three
today.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Because, I mean, what a great bite. I mean, I would love that coming out, you know, on the side of my like good homemade granola yogurt. And like that would just be a great, rich accompaniment. But it's just not what you're doing when the assignment is showcase seafood.
Yeah. And I wrote this down. Colicchio didn't have a huge zinger of a pun in the episode, but on the Last Chance Kitchen episode, he said, "Joe, you're turning the gooey duck into tilefish."
Yeah, when he dropped it on the floor, that was actually brilliant.
It's like, wow, Tom.
That was brilliant.
It's like a little softball, and he just cranked it over the green monster, man. That was amazing.
Yeah, so I'm happy that I've learned a new thing, geoduck.
Yeah.
A word I've seen but never heard spoken. Though I am familiar with the giant clam, and I think that is what we know as when you get like giant – I'm assuming, and someone correct me if I'm wrong, that if I go to a really good sushi joint and giant clam is what I'm ordering with the shiso, that is geoduck, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But I'm not certain.
So Joe Sasto prevails with his gooey duck with that puree, which Chef Mike didn't really care for, and there was some disagreement about having the puree underneath – versus what Joe went with it, which is smothering it on top of the dish. But from the actual precise cut of the gooey duck, I feel like he was he had the most complete dish, and it showed the most I would say thought and actual skill. So he survives. And Kevin, you have the two chefs that are in the bottom that have been eliminated are on your team, Kevin, and there are a couple holes in your boat that you need to plug so far, but it's early in the competition. Last Chance Kitchen is, I think we said it last season, Kevin, but I really enjoy Last Chance Kitchen. I feel like it's gotten so much better over the years. And I feel like it's not as must see TV as the episode itself, but it is right there with it. 11 minutes, 12 minutes, which is very, very, the perfect amount of time on Last Chance Kitchen. And I just
very snackable.
I think it's a great, so for people who are just skipping out on Last Chance Kitchen because of the, I don't know, the barrier of entry by just having to go online and Googling it, like you got to watch it. It's good. And Joe Sasto gets his redemption and he survives another day.
Yeah. I mean, my issue is going to be when you start, you know, when my team is much smaller than your team, in this competition, I just have fewer opportunities to pick up points. So I need some more tens. I need Gillespie and Nini and possibly Karen to bang me out some wins because that's my only way back into this thing. I mean, I'm not that far behind, but I am a little concerned because, you know, now it's 7-on-5 and, you know, maybe I pick up a point in Last Chance, but
do you remember the trade proposal I gave you last week?
No, remind me.
I think it was Angelo and Stephanie for Melissa. and you turned it down.
So I would have netted 8.
Yeah.
Already.
Yeah. And you would not
have netted 8 because it's -6 to -2.
Man, feeling good about that. Feel good about that.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So if that trade went through, I would absorbed an eliminated chef and Stephanie, who had one of the biggest whiffs we've had so far this season. So, hey, she can,
I'm more confident than Stephanie though. Yeah. Like, I think I think Brian Malarkey might not be long for this competition. Also, I would say this something. I think Leanne Wong might not be long for this competition.
You're right. No, we'll see. We'll see. Kevin, what an episode this was. I thought this was a great week on Top Chef and a wonderful tribute to Jonathan Gold. But I'm excited for what episode 3 was.
For Tom Haberstroh, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.